It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we check out a new project that aims to confirm or deny online rumors before they spread out of control.
But first, there's been a lot of talk about how coal-fired plants affect air quality and even the climate, but less attention has been paid to the millions of tons of waste generated by coal-fired plants and now buried beneath our feet.
In past decades, coal-fired burners were used everywhere from power plants to hospitals. Coal ash, the byproduct of burning coal, contains substances like molybdenum, lead, arsenic, and mercury.
While environmentalists have sought to classify coal ash as hazardous waste, the EPA recently established rules to classify it as garbage, which means less oversight in how it's disposed of. With us now to talk about this is Ron Seely, reporter and editor with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to start by taking a look at this EPA decision, because that is something a lot of people have been waiting for a long time. The decision to classify coal ash as being garbage and not necessarily hazardous waste. What's the story behind that, and what was the reaction to that decision after it was released?
Yeah, I think at the point that it was finally came last week, it didn't surprise a lot of people that they ended up classifying it as, you know, solid waste, or as you say, like household garbage. The enviros and environmentalists and others are not happy with that because, you know, they wanted it classified as hazardous waste, which would have required it to be disposed of in appropriate landfills, lined landfills and so forth. It also might have given more emphasis to regulation of what's called beneficial reuse of coal ash, which is the use of various types of coal ash in building and construction and road projects and so forth. But as it is, that program will continue. And again, the oversight of coal ash, it won't change really much of how we're handling coal ash in Wisconsin, I'm told by Ann Coakley, who manages waste for the DNR.
And there has been another study, too, that came out recently, the Clean Wisconsin study, that took a look at this topic. And I have to tell you, I was surprised by the extent to which coal ash is present everywhere from where I can tell.
We were, too. And that's why we picked up the story and ran with it and have expanded on it now in our latest look at the problem. This study, the Clean Wisconsin study, focused on southeastern Wisconsin, primarily coal ash from We Energies, especially their Big Oak Creek plant over there. I don't know if you'll recall, but they had a big collapse of a coal ash, pile of coal ash that was like 200 feet tall a couple of years ago.
Yeah, right into the lake, right? Or right near the lake?
Absolutely, right. It was right on the shore of the lake. It started out as a ravine and was turned into a mountain by the disposal of coal ash. And they built some facilities on top of it. But so that, you know, coal ash has been an issue for some time. Mostly we hear about it from in the southern states, where they put this material in a slurry kind of, you know, it's in a slurry mix, and they put it in impoundments where, and when those fail, it can be a real problem. There have been some failures down there that have just released millions of tons of this material, and which is a bad thing because, like you said in the introduction, it contains some pretty toxic metals when ingested at, you know, at least at high doses, high levels.
Yeah, and as we were talking about earlier, it's in more places than you think. You mentioned the term beneficial reuse, and that's a very specific term here in Wisconsin.
It is, and we lead the state in beneficial reuse, actually. I think about 85% of the coal ash produced by utilities and paper mills and so forth goes to these construction uses. There's two kinds of beneficial reuse or reuse. There's it's used in encapsulated form. It's also used in an unencapsulated form. Fly ash, the stuff that goes up the chimneys and is caught in baggers, most of it, is a very fine talcum-like powder. And that has the properties of cement, which is used to bind concrete and asphalt. So, you know, that material hardens, and it's not as likely to leach these contaminants into the groundwater. But there are also millions of tons used in encapsulated form that is just spread loosely under buildings and under roadbeds for fill. A Highway 12 between Middleton and Sauk City is built largely on coal ash fill.
And, you know, it's interesting, too, because we've got the coal ash fill that is sort of everywhere, as you say, under our feet. And then you've got landfills and so forth. And there are issues, as I understand it, with water contamination. There's the possibility of breathing some of this stuff. It has really turned into a much larger story, I think, than a lot of people would have guessed at first blush.
It has. And we're focusing primarily on the impact on groundwater at Wisconsin Watch, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We're really focusing on water issues, and this is one of the big issues that's come up here lately, and especially with the federal ruling. Now we're going to be taking a look at this. What we tried to do in our latest story is push this story a little more statewide, because Clean Wisconsin focused on southeastern Wisconsin, where there are hundreds and hundreds of people who can't drink their water because of contaminants like molybdenum and boron. We talked to one fellow, Frank Michener, who his dog won't even drink the water. So, you know, you have these issues. But we found when we started looking, and back when I was a reporter for the State Journal, I actually turned up a lot of coal ash in East Madison. The Isthmus of Madison is built on coal ash. It used to be mostly a marsh and swampy areas, and they're filled in with coal ash over the years. So, and the water utilities testing for molybdenum, chromium has already shown up in our water, but the utility believes that's probably from naturally occurring and not at high enough levels that would indicate it might be coming from coal ash. But certainly people are aware of it now, and more aware now that the study's been done.
And what's the Wisconsin DNR's response been to all of this?
The DNR was not didn't really have they criticized the Clean Wisconsin study. They had done a study of their own. It was limited in its scope, only about 25 wells. The Clean Wisconsin study focused on 1,000 wells that had been tested through other testing projects and We Energies. But the DNR says that they don't believe that there is a correlation between the coal ash buried in southeastern Wisconsin and the levels of contaminants that they're finding in wells. They criticized the study because they said that it used too little data in too big of an area. And so they still are saying that there really isn't a connection. There are a lot of people who disagree with them, especially after, I think, this Clean Wisconsin study. The DNR has said that they would like to see more studies, but they're not going to do them because they said, they say they can't afford them. They are willing to collaborate possibly with researchers at a university like University of Wisconsin to study the connections.
So where does this leave us right now? We've got these new EPA regulations or new classifications, I should say, in place. But earlier you said that it really isn't going to change the way business is done in Wisconsin. So are we looking for more research, for more answers? And in the meantime, it's business as usual?
Yeah, I think we are. I think there has to be more study of this connection specifically between the metals and I'm along a highway here, so I'm having to move real quick. Hold on. Sorry about that. And I just think, I think the Clean Wisconsin study really set the table, and there's going to have to be a harder look at this also, statewide, because we have coal ash everywhere. Yeah, I appreciate it. One more thing real quick. This was a project that we did as part of our project at the University of Wisconsin Journalism School called The Confluence. And I had several journalism students that helped me on the story, and we're really proud of the work they did.
Well, that's good to know. Thanks, Ron.
Uh-huh.
Talking with Ron Seely, reporter and editor with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Is McDonald's getting rid of the Big Mac? Did a high school student in New York make over $70 million in the stock market? Well, the answers are no and no, but both of those stories went viral recently. Stories like that show up on our social media pages, or they arrive in our inboxes. They might be shared by friends. Something outrageous, something funny, or something just too good to be true.
And that leaves us trying to figure out what is true. And it's not just our friends. Sometimes even journalists get sucked in and share stories that turn out to be, well, non-existent. And once that rumor or story starts making the rounds and goes viral, there's no taking it back.
Our next guest is looking to change all of that. His new project, The Emergent Website, aims to track online rumors in real time and then confirm or deny them as quickly as possible.
Craig Silverman joins us now. He's a fellow at Columbia University's Toe Center for Digital Media. He works with the Poynter Institute. He's the author of the book and blog titled Regret the Error and founder of Emergent.info. Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the why. Why take on this tall order to, in effect, fact check the internet?
Well, I think it is a tall order, but at the same time, the average person, they see stuff on Facebook, they see stuff on Twitter, in their email, as you mentioned, and it's really, they're not sure about whether it's true or not. And sometimes we take action based on things we see and read and hear that turn out to not be true. And so I think it's really, really important in an interconnected society where information travels so quickly that we can try and match the speed of information with an element of quality to it. So, you know, I've been working on accuracy in journalism for about a decade, and this problem is arguably a much bigger one and a harder one to tackle, but certainly worthwhile.
So what kind of stories make the cut to get the emergent treatment?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the ones that I'm working on today that people might have seen is there have been a lot of stories just over the last 24 hours or even less than that claiming that the president of Argentina became the adopted godmother of a boy in Argentina. And this was done to prevent him from becoming a werewolf.
I've seen that headline, yes.
So it's a very clickable headline. And the root of it, according to all these articles that have come out, is that, you know, there's a legend in Argentina that the seventh son born in a family, is likely to become a werewolf. Mm-hmm. And that there was even legislation on the books to try and counteract this legend. And so this is a story that started with the Jewish Telegraphic Agency a few days ago, but it's spread and it's been reported by a lot of very large websites. And just within the last few hours, The Guardian has come out with a report saying that, well, no, there's a tradition that the president of Argentina, you know, does a sort of ceremonial adoption of any seventh child born to a family. It has nothing to do with the werewolf legend. So this is something that has gone very far, been covered by a lot of places, and now we're starting to see other information emerge that really counteracts what everyone has probably already read and heard about it.
So where I'm seeing this, and this is a theme I know with the work you're doing, this isn't just something that my buddy is putting up on Facebook or, you know, it's showing up in my email inbox. Media outlets are picking up these stories, seeing them, and I guess pasting them in without confirming them, right?
Yeah, this is, and that's a big focus of the research that I've been doing at Columbia, where I've been looking at how news organizations deal with rumors and unverified claims. And so we created a database where we would identify, you know, a rumor that's out there that's being reported and re-reported by news outlets. And then we would sort of look at the stories and see, well, okay, you know, how are they treating this? And look over time to see when that rumor was confirmed or debunked, do these news organizations ever go back and update? And one thing that we see, which probably wouldn't surprise people, is that, of course, you know, once one news organization jumps on something, then you see a bunch of others come right, you know, quickly after it, and they, you know, all point back to that original one. So there isn't a lot of reporting and verification being done. It's a lot of what somebody once called journalism as an act of pointing. Hey, there's this thing over here, and we're going to tell you about it, but we're not actually going to, you know, add anything more to it.
So what's the media pressure on somebody, whether they're, you know, a traditional newspaper with a website or a web-only presence, to leap on that kind of clickbait story fast without worrying about whether it's true or not?
Yeah, I mean, the incentives are to move very quickly because you're if you are early to it and you push it out through your social channels, the chances of you being the one to sort of dominate that story are greater. And the reward for that is traffic and attention. And that actually translates into dollars because, you know, the more traffic you have, the more you can charge for your ads. And so there's a very clear link between jumping on things early, trying to get it first and get all the attention for it, and actually, you know, potentially earning revenue or just seeing a lot of shares and a lot of traffic and attention from that, which are things that are valued inside news organizations. So, and of course, the other piece of it is an element of, well, other people are doing it too. You know, there's enough big websites out there that just jump on anything they can find that others see, well, they're having success doing that. Why don't we do that as well? And maybe we can get a little bit of that traffic. And so a lot of the incentives are making journalists move very quickly. You know, a lot of news sites are asking their journalists to produce as much content as possible, as quickly as possible. And so things like verification and making a couple phone calls and checking into them start to fall by the wayside when you can get lots of traffic if you jump on it quickly.
Now, I've been reading for years the website Snopes.com, which aims to debunk urban legends now that usually spread via email or now social media. What are you doing maybe that's different than what they've been doing?
Well, Snopes is fantastic, and I've been, you know, reading them for a long time as well. You know, they've been around, I believe, for about 20 years now. And so Snopes do the excellent work of, you know, something gets submitted to them, maybe somebody saw something in their email or they see something online, and then Snopes will actually do the work that, you know, journalists should be doing, which is to track things back, to figure out, and then they make a determination based on that. So for me, one of the things we're doing with Emergent that's a little bit different is, you know, we're aggregating a lot of the news coverage that's being done and showing you what different sources are saying about a given claim. And we're often jumping on things, you know, when they are in that unverified stage to almost put up kind of a caution flag to people to say, look, this is unverified, and we'll update it as true or false as things emerge. But we're trying to get in things a little bit earlier when you don't necessarily know what the truth is. And so that's one piece of it. The other is, of course, you know, I'm trying to spend a lot of time looking at these viral stories that go out there. Snopes also looks at, you know, email chains and things like that. So, I mean, I think that they're definitely complementary sites. And in truth, we really need more of them if we're actually going to be able to attack this problem.
Now, I gather you're hoping things change. What would you like to see from media outlets to, A, not reprint the false story, and B, to react when they have been hoodwinked?
Yeah, I mean, on the first piece of it, I think that news organizations are really squandering some of the value that's there. They're taking a lot of the a very short-term approach, saying, well, it's out there, let's just get it up as quickly as we can. My experience looking into these things is that if you actually spend sometimes as little as 5 minutes kind of poking around and seeing, well, where did this originate and who's claiming this, you can actually be the person to add some value and put new information out there or even say, you know what, this isn't true and here's why. And there are certainly examples where you get a decent amount of traffic doing that. So I'd like to see, rather than instantly going to propagation, actually taking a little bit of time and seeing, well, can we add something to this story that's not out there? And I think that would be a great thing for news organizations to do, is to kind of counteract this, you know, just jump on anything that's out there strategy.
And if they have gotten it wrong, should they just disappear it and make it go away? Or what's the right media etiquette to say, hey, we got this thing wrong?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very long tradition, started in newspapers, obviously, of corrections, where if you get something wrong, you need to admit it publicly. And what's happened now in the digital environment is people can actually go in and they can kind of erase things from a story and republish it, and you'd never know what was there before. And that's dishonest and it's unethical. And so absolutely, if you're going to jump on the rumor, if you're going to put something out there, you absolutely have a responsibility to come back to it later on. And one of the things that was identified in the research, unfortunately, is that a lot of times news organizations are writing about things that are not, you know, verified yet. We don't know whether they're true or false. And they're writing about them with headlines that actually declare them to be true. And even if they go back a couple days later and update the body text, they sometimes leave the headline there.
Oh, no.
And so people are reading the headline and being told it's true and then getting the dissonance of the body text saying something else. And research that's out there says very clearly people retain the headline most of all.
Well, Craig, you've read a lot of stories that have turned out to be bunk. For us as consumers, can you give us some red flags or warning signs that we should maybe doubt the thing we're reading if it's on social media or maybe even in a legitimate outlet?
Yeah, so a couple things come to mind. The first one is that I see a lot of stories that start in, you know, another part of the world, and then they end up, you know, in North American outlets or British outlets, and it's an amazing story from China or from Romania or somewhere like that. And if there's this kind of language barrier and geographic barrier that this story has left, oftentimes there are things that get lost in translation, or it's sometimes just completely made up. So if it's a story, you know, that's centered in a foreign place in a foreign language and it seems kind of incredible, you should be particularly cautious about that. The other one is just as you're reading news articles and seeing things that are out there, you want to ask yourself, well, what is the source of this actual item? And a lot of times what you see is they'll point to another news outlet, or they may not not cite any particular source at all. Some of these stories just seem to be, you know, created out of nowhere. And so I'd really encourage people to ask the question of, well, where is this information coming from as they read it? And a lot of times that will tell you, well, okay, they haven't actually done any reporting here. They're pointing me somewhere else. And if you follow that back a little bit, you usually end up somewhere that the story might actually be different than the one you just read.
A lot of these stories spread because they're just, we want to believe them. You know, quote the X-Files, I want to believe. Do you ever get accused of being a killjoy when you debunk those?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that I want to figure out better ways of doing is because, as you exactly what you just said, being the one who says, oh, you know what, that's not true, you're the spoil sport, you're the killjoy. And people actually, you know, they don't want to necessarily hear that. And we know from a lot of research, people, of course, are more likely to believe things that are in line with their pre-existing beliefs. And so it's actually completely ineffective a lot of the time to say, well, hey, that's not true if somebody is deeply invested in it. And so we need to find ways to make the debunking just as appealing as you know, those amazing but false tales. And I think that's a pretty tall order.
We'll keep watching that. Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Craig Silverman. He's founder of Emergent.info. We have a link to their fact-checking site on the Central Time Facebook page. More than 570 people in Milwaukee have been wounded by gunfire this year, an increase of about 7% over last year. Non-fatal shootings have also occurred in several other Wisconsin communities. Police and physicians say more of the wounded would have died, except that the medical system is getting better at dealing with gunshot wounds. Chuck Quirnbach filed this report.
It's the inside of Bouchard's, a clothing store on Martin Luther King Drive in Milwaukee. Police say that on November 18th, two armed robbers came in and shot the store manager in the chest during a gun battle. Another employee, Alan Atra, says it was difficult to see his colleague go down.
Anybody don't, you know, come to work, you don't expect something like that, and you're not deserving of something like that. You're trying to earn your daily bread, you know, and take care of your family.
The 36-year-old store manager is apparently recovering from his wound, but he's just one of more than 570 people in Milwaukee who have survived a shooting this year, in part because of quick work by police and paramedics preserving a victim's vital signs, and soon after, the work of local hospitals. Doors to the trauma center open at Frederick Hospital in Wauwatosa. 200 to 300 gunfire victims are brought in every year, and the great majority make it out alive. Dr. Steve Hargarten and other medical personnel here have been treating gunshot wounds for decades. Hargarten says besides the knowledge gained through experience, one thing helping keep people alive is better medical images of where a bullet has passed through a body.
And the path suggests what the bullet has damaged, what organ it has traversed that has caused damage. The primary goal is repairing, controlling hemorrhage. The primary goal is organ repair.
Hargarten is also professor and chair of emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He acknowledges that even when some people survive being shot, their quality of life may decrease.
Certainly those devastating injuries, such as bullets to the head or spinal cord, leave little opportunities for maximizing outcomes. And they oftentimes, and in fact predictably, are having a life of disability.
So Dr. Hargarten and others also speak out on reducing gunfire.
Who wants to be the health commissioner, deputy for the city of Milwaukee?
At a gun violence prevention summit at UW-Milwaukee this month, Hargarten urged young people to view flying bullets as kinetic energy causing a public health threat.
And think about your leadership role in how you can prevent the transmission of that kinetic energy, because once that energy gets placed in the brain or in the chest, it's pretty bad.
But the shootings continue in Milwaukee. In separate incidents this past weekend, a 13-month-old boy was killed and five adults were wounded. Mayor Tom Barrett says there are various challenges to target.
And I go back to the illegal guns, I go back to the illegal drugs, the illegal gang activity. That's what this is focused on. And we're going to continue to put a lot of police department resources into solving these crimes and preventing these crimes.
Asked if state government could help Milwaukee, Barrett says the city has not received significant assistance. Governor Walker and Republican state lawmakers dispute that, but when you add gun homicide victims to non-fatal shooting victims in Milwaukee this year, the total nears 650, or about 45 more than last year. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're in the last week of 2014, and it's a good time to take a look back at the year that was.
And today we check out the year in science with Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha and one of our regular science guests here on Central Time. Gemma, good to have you back.
Hello and Happy New Year, gentlemen.
Well, in your latest issue, you looked back at the top science stories of 2014. Number one on the list was the Ebola outbreak. Was it easy to make that call?
Well, there are so many reasons for it. I mean, we've known about Ebola for decades. This is the first time it's really popped out of an isolated outbreak into a real epidemic that is, at last count, 20,000 people infected with the virus, and I think about 7,700 of them have died of it. So this is way, way exponentially bigger than any other Ebola outbreak. It involved a much larger area, multitudes more people. It went global as well. And so there's that aspect of it that makes it really remarkable and newsworthy. But there's also the aspect of it that, as horrible as this outbreak is, it really was a kind of kick in the pants to the research and development of treatment for this horrible virus. And that is the really interesting science part of it, that there are now a number of different therapies and vaccines that they're working on. None of them are, you know, really ready to roll, but it's really speeding up the pipeline. And that, you know, it's a great thing because Ebola is going to be with us forever. it's not going away even after this outbreak winds down, which I hope is soon.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to mention. You know, sometimes stories come and go, and what's hot one year is nowhere the next. But this one has the possibility that it could still be in the 100 top stories next year.
Absolutely. And, you know, hopefully next year we'll be reporting that they found a super effective, super cheap vaccine. Wouldn't that be great? But, you know, they're talking about the World Health Organization and other institutions are talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people potentially being infected with this virus before the current outbreak and epidemic winds down.
And Gemma, before we move on to some of the other top science stories, do you see the reaction to Ebola maybe paving the way toward preparedness, not just for Ebola, but for other world epidemic emergencies like this in the future?
Well, you know, it would be really nice to say, yes, this is going to be the slap in the face that people have needed for a long time. But I hate to say it. As humans, you know, we have notoriously short attention spans, and let's keep our fingers crossed, but I think if we get a good treatment or vaccine for Ebola, that will be a big victory in and of itself.
Moving on to your number two science story for the year, it had to do with the West Antarctic ice sheet collapsing, and that's been going on for some time, but what bumped it up to number two this year?
Well, there were a couple studies that came out this year, actually I think in March, April timeframe, that really illustrated it has passed the point of no return. And what's happened is as the glaciers have been melting and calving off these monstrous icebergs into the Amundsen Sea, you know, as the glaciers melt, kind of underneath them, the seawater, which is warmer, just kind of creeps up underneath further and further, and the seawater itself is warming as that particular part of the Great Southern Ocean warms. So it's warming and warming, and if you imagine, you know, an ice cube and you're putting hot liquid under it, it's going to melt a lot faster, and that's what's happening. So they're past the point of no return. They're not sure how long it's going to take to melt the entire ice sheet. It could take centuries, but once it's melted, the sea level is going to rise, I think, 10 feet is the figure I'm seeing the most.
So this is potentially dire news in the short to medium term. Are there any hopeful sides that researchers are pointing to on this?
Well, you know, there's still research. That's the key, because this rate is really unprecedented in recorded history, and they're really trying to understand the climate data going back. You know, they have ice cores going back 400,000 years, and they're trying to understand how previous melt and thaw cycles have worked. And, you know, the good news is because it may take centuries, we'll hopefully have enough time to relocate populations and urban centers away from the coast, which is going to be inundated. But I'm sorry, I feel like the Grim Reaper today.
Yeah.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Well, yeah, I was going to say your top two stories, very important stories, worth putting on the list. But on the bad news side, number three, a more hopeful one, up in space.
Yeah, I think number three is an awesome story, and it is all about the Rosetta Comet Rendezvous. I think a lot of us were following it in the late summer and fall as the European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft actually went into orbit around a comet 4 billion miles away. And when you think of the achievement, all the things that had to fall into place for that to happen, it is just staggering. And, you know, hats off to the ESA. What a great job. I know that the initial success and jubilation kind of turned to, oh, man, when the lander they dropped in November didn't quite land where they thought it would. It's a solar-powered lander, and it landed in shadow, so it's in hibernation now. And, the thing with that, when I heard that story, a lot of people seem to think, like, oh, so it's a bust. Like, no, it is fantastic that, you know, humans, us puny humans, have a spacecraft in orbit around a comet. And the actual spacecraft, the Rosetta, is going to continue to give us valuable information that's going to take them years to sort out all the data that Rosetta is giving us. So even though the lander had some trouble and is hibernating now, we're still getting a ton of benefit, and it's an incredible achievement.
And let's talk about some of those benefits for a second. What can we learn from landing on a comet?
Well, for starters, we got an up-close and personal first-ever view of the comet's nucleus, and that's the rock and ice that forms its heart. So right away, we're seeing things we've never seen before. We're able to analyze the orbit, the actual path of the orbit, and understand a little bit more about how comets move and work, and just the chemical composition. You know, before it unfortunately switched into hibernation, the lander did send back a lot of information about the chemical composition, some of the information about the rocks, and that's super valuable information that we never had before, and it's a great thing. I'm a big Rosetta fan.
We're talking to Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak about the top stories from the year in science.
And you can join in the discussion, too. What do you think was the most important science news from 2014? What story stuck with you all year long or raised up in your estimation? Give us a call. Join in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or you can also post your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. We're taking a look at the year in science with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak.
And you can join in. What do you think was the most important science story of 2014? Was there science news that you really got excited or curious about? And maybe what are you looking forward to in 2015? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Gemma, we've talked about disease, global warming. We've gone out into space. Now let's get into technology. Another big story on your list was flaws with cybersecurity. And I think you might have gone to press before this whole thing on the interview as well brought cybersecurity really up front in the headlines.
Yes. In fact, our magazine was on newsstands in early December, so we had no chance to report on this. But it kind of really speaks to what our chat with Eugene Spafford, who is a longtime security expert for computers, really the highlights that he made in his chat with us. And his basic point, which I think really whether you're looking at the interview and the Sony debacle, whether you're looking at Home Depot and Target and J.P. Morgan Chase, all of these problems stem from very dedicated criminals exploiting really sloppy design. I mean, that's what Eugene Spafford, who we interview, it calls it. It's really, we took these general-purpose computers and we're asking them to do all kinds of things that they were not really designed for. And then when a bug or a glitch or a vulnerability pops up, we just patch it. I mean, think about, you know, if it was the hull of a boat and you just kept patching it. You know what I mean? It would be, you know,
spackle keep this afloat.
Exactly. And you know, there were only so many patches, and maybe you're not patching it just right. Maybe, you know, another hole opens up. So he really points out that we have to, as a society, really rethink how we approach computer security and stop thinking about patches and start thinking about designing machines for specific purposes, which will innately allow a much higher level of security. Because cyber hackers aren't going away. You know, Ebola, climate change, cyber hackers, they're not going away. I'm sorry, I'm such the Grim Reaper today. I apologize.
So what are we supposed to do? Who's supposed to take the lead on this? Is this going to come out of the private sector? Is it something government should get involved in?
Well, that's a really good question, and in fact, we asked him that very question, and he basically sees this as something that really should be taken up on a local scale. You know, we've got these local extension services for, say, agriculture. If you find a weird bug in your garden, you can contact someone and say, hey, you know, what's this bug about? And if we could do that with computers rather than, you know, try to contact some shadowy government organization, and it would make the reporting and the fixing hopefully much smoother. And he explains it much more eloquently than I can in 10 seconds, but he does have a solution.
I'm going to jump down a little further on your list, Gemma. I know you are a big fan of stories about human prehistory, human evolution, where we came from, and a story that we actually talked to you briefly about earlier this year, maybe a mystery solved, a DNA sequence of an ancient American human genome.
Yeah, this is a really exciting story, and I remember chatting with you briefly about it last winter, but it's even gotten more exciting because in February, they sequenced the first ancient American. They sequenced his DNA from an infant boy known as Anzac I, and they found out that his people were directly ancestral to 80% of Native Americans and very closely related to the other 20%. They also were able to trace his lineage back to Siberia. So this really is the first time that through DNA sequencing, we can definitively say, yes, the first Americans came over from Siberia over the land bridge that was between Siberia and Alaska. And this is important because there were alternate theories floating about saying, no, they came from Europe, they came from here, they came from there. But so we finally have definitive DNA proof. And then in May, you know, just a couple months later, another ancient first American skeleton's DNA was sequenced. And we learned a little bit more about the fact that she, too, you know, clearly related the same way to those Siberian peoples coming over the land bridge. But we also learned a lot more about their facial features, their facial morphology, because her skull, she was a teenage girl, researchers named her Naya. Naya's skull was found. The remains were found with the skull. So we were learning a lot more about the first Americans, which has always been, you know, a big question mark, because we haven't had really solid, hardcore DNA data.
So back the doom and gloom for a second here as we move on to number eight. A story here about scientific fraud within the scientific research community. And I know, you know, we're not supposed to trust stuff on the internet, but when it comes to like peer-reviewed journals and so forth, we can't trust things there either?
Well, I want to disagree with you. I don't think this is a doom and gloom story. I think this is actually, there is a silver lining in this story. As we looked at, you know, it's tragic that this one senior researcher took his own life because the paper he supervised another researcher writing was retracted. And there have been a number of other incidents in 2014 of papers where either the statistics were made up or the photos were fudged, all different kinds of issues. And, you know, the authors of this article point out that one of the reasons there seems to be more fraud is that scientists as a community are actually policing themselves better. So there seems to be more fraud out there because they're getting better at finding it, and that's actually a good thing. You know, so the peer-reviewed journal article will always kind of be the gold standard for credibility, but now scientists are looking at it much more closely and not just taking it, you know, oh, it's peer-reviewed in a quality journal, we're good. They're trying to replicate the results of experiments and really kind of knock down any theories, and that's a good thing because science is all about testing, retesting, and exploring possible new explanations.
Well, Gemma, I don't want to get through the year in science without bringing up a dinosaur, and the Spinosaurus made an appearance on your list, or Spinosaurus, correct me either way.
I call him Spinosaurus.
Okay, good.
So I think we're good. But, yeah, this is a fantastic, and it's exciting, and it's good news. Yay! Spinosaurus aegypticus is the largest land predator ever known, which that in itself is super cool because it's bigger than T-Rex, but that's not really the most interesting thing about it. It is a crazy Frankenstein dinosaur. It is nuts. It's got like a crocodilian snout. It has these weird flat feet that they think were webbed. It's got a 7-foot-high sail on its back. So it has all these bizarre features that for years they couldn't figure out what the heck this thing was, and then they found this new skeleton that answered a lot of the questions. And the answer is, it's so weird looking because it is the first and only aquatic dinosaur we've ever found. That's why it has all these weird things. Like, for example, it's the only dinosaur that has no central cavity in its limb bones. We see that in like hippos and penguins and other aquatic animals because it spent most of its time in the water. And I just think that's really cool because, you know, we always think, oh, with dinosaurs, yeah, we know so much already. Now we're just kind of filling in the little gaps in the record. And the truth is, here is a huge gap in the record that we didn't really appreciate how weird and odd and wonderful it was until this year.
Well, Gemma, thanks for sharing those. A lot of other really interesting stories on your list, and we'll be talking about a lot more in 2015. Thanks for joining us.
Sounds great, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. That's Gemma Tarlak. She is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha with us today to talk about the year in science, and she joins us usually once a month to talk about some, you know, some of the most intriguing stories that are going on throughout the year here on Central Time. The holidays are a big eating season. I've mostly kept things under control this year.
Sure you have.
Yeah. Oh, no, I've done pretty well. Well, one state paper, though, got into the dining spirit. The Wisconsin State Journal did a slideshow on beloved restaurants that are no longer with us. They got a big response from their readers.
They sure did. That piece, though, focused just on Madison. So we wanted to throw that question out to the entire state of Wisconsin. Do you have a favorite restaurant that you wish was still around, that really pops into your head when you're thinking of a place you'd like to go out to eat at? Give that restaurant a shout out right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
I could go on for an hour on ones that I miss. A Mexican restaurant called El Charo in Madison. It was great after a night of celebration.
Okay.
We'll say one called Taqueria Gila Monster. There's a Fife's in Madison. A lot of places that when my wife and I are looking for a date night, if those places were still here, we'd go to them. You have some from around the state, I think, Gene.
Sure. Well, I lived in La Crosse for many, many years. And if you go back to La Crosse, one of the restaurants people still talk about, it's been closed now for 20 years, it's called Waltz. Old Time Supper Club. It was right down by the brewery, and everybody in La Crosse went to it. And if they were still doing fish fries, I would go to the new Villa on Ward Avenue in a heartbeat, but it's gone.
It's gone. Sorry. Well, we'll need a time machine to go back and eat these great restaurants.
I would go there, man. I would go there.